Poirot looked with interest at the tall, dignified young woman who entered the room. He rose and bowed to her politely.
"Mrs. Lennox Boynton? Hercule Poirot, at your service."
Nadine Boynton sat down. Her thoughtful eyes were on Poirot's face.
"I hope you do not mind, madame, my intruding on your sorrow in this way."
Her eyes did not waver. She did not reply at once. Her eyes remained steady and grave. At last she gave a sigh and said, "I think it is best for me to be quite frank with you, Monsieur Poirot."
"I agree with you, madame."
"You apologized for intruding upon my sorrow. That sorrow, Monsieur Poirot, does not exist, and it is idle to pretend that it does. I had no love for my mother-in-law, and I cannot honestly say that I regret her death."
"Thank you, madame, for your plain speaking,"
Nadine went on. "Still, although I cannot pretend sorrow, I can admit to another feeling. Remorse."
"Remorse?"
Poirot's eyebrows went up. "Yes, because, you see, it was I who brought about her death. For that I blame myself bitterly."
"What is this that you are saying, madame?"
"I am saying that I was the cause of my mother-in-law's death. I was acting, as I thought, honestly. But the result was unfortunate. To all intents and purposes, I killed her."
Poirot leaned back in his chair. "Will you be so kind as to elucidate this statement, madame?"
Nadine bent her head. "Yes, that is what I wish to do. My first reaction, naturally, was to keep my private affairs to myself. But I see that the time has come when it would be better to speak out. I have no doubt, Monsieur Poirot, that you have often received confidences of a somewhat intimate nature."
"That, yes."
"Then I will tell you quite simply what occurred. My married life, Monsieur Poirot, has not been particularly happy. My husband is not entirely to blame for that. His mother's influence over him has been unfortunate. But I have been feeling, for some time, that my life was becoming intolerable."
She paused and then went on.
"On the afternoon of my mother-in-law's death, I came to a decision. I have a friend, a very good friend. He has suggested more than once that I should throw in my lot with him. On that afternoon, I accepted his proposal."
"You decided to leave your husband?"
"Yes."
"Continue, madame."
Nadine said in a lower voice, "Having once made my decision, I wanted to establish it as soon as possible. I walked home to the camp by myself. My mother-in-law was sitting alone. There was no one about, and I decided to break the news to her there and then. I got a chair, sat down by her, and told her abruptly what I had decided."
"She was surprised?"
"Yes. I'm afraid it was a great shock to her. She was both surprised and angry, very angry. She worked herself into quite a state about it. Presently, I refused to discuss the matter any longer. I got up and walked away." Her voice dropped.
I never saw her again, alive.
Poirot nodded his head slowly. He said,
"I see."
Then he said, "You think her death was the result of the shock?"
"It seems to me almost certain. You see, she had already overexerted herself considerably getting to this place. My news and her anger at it would do the rest. I feel additionally guilty because I have had a certain amount of training in illness, and so I, more than anyone else, ought to have realized the possibility of such a thing happening."
Poirot sat in silence for some minutes. Then he said,
"What exactly did you do when you left her?"
"I took the chair I had brought out back into my cave, then I went down to the marquee. My husband was there."
Poirot watched her closely as he said, "Did you tell him of your decision, or had you already told him?"
There was a pause, an infinitesimal pause, before Nadine said, "I told him then."
"How did he take it?"
She answered quietly,
"He was very upset." "Did he urge you to reconsider your decision?"
She shook her head.
He He didn't say very much. You see, we had both known for some time that something like this might happen. Poirot said, "You will pardon me, but the other man was, of course, Mr. Jefferson Cope?"
She bent her head.
"Yes."
There was a long pause. Then, without any change of voice, Poirot asked,
"Do you own a hypodermic syringe, madame?"
"Yes. No."
His eyebrows rose.
She explained, "I have an old hypodermic, amongst other things, in a travelling medicine chest, but it is in our big luggage, which we left in Jerusalem."
"I see."
There was a pause. Then she said, with a shiver of uneasiness,
"Why did you ask me that, Monsieur Poirot?"
He did not answer the question. Instead, he put one of his own.
"Mrs. Boynton was, I believe, taking a mixture containing digitalis."
"Yes." He thought that she was definitely watchful now.
"That was for her heart trouble?"
"Yes.
Digitalis is, to some extent, a cumulative drug."
"I believe it is. I don't know very much about it."
"If Mrs. Boynton had taken a big overdose of digitalis—"
She interrupted him quickly, but with decision. "She did not. She was always most careful. So was I, if I measured the dose for her."
"There might have been an overdose in this particular bottle, a mistake of the chemist who made it up."
"I think that is very unlikely," she replied quietly.
"Ah, well, the analysis will soon tell us."
Nadine said, "Unfortunately, the bottle was broken." Poirot eyed her with sudden interest.
"Indeed. Who broke it?"
"I'm not quite sure. One of the servants, I think. In carrying my mother-in-law's body into her cave, there was a good deal of confusion, and the light was very poor. A table got knocked over." Poirot eyed her steadily for a minute or two.
"That," he said, "is very interesting."
Nadine Boynton shifted wearily in her chair. "You are suggesting, I think, that my mother-in-law did not die of shock, but of an overdose of digitalis?" she said, and went on, "That seems to me most improbable."
Poirot leaned forward. "Even when I tell you that Dr. Gérard, the French physician who was staying in the camp, had missed an appreciable quantity of a preparation of digitoxin from his medicine chest?"
Her face grew very pale. He saw the clutch of her hand on the table. Her eyes dropped. She sat very still. She was like a Madonna carved in stone.
"Well, madame," said Poirot at last, "what have you to say to that?"
The seconds ticked on, but she did not speak. It was quite 2 minutes before she raised her head, and he started a little when he saw the look in her eyes.
"Monsieur Poirot, I did not kill my mother-in-law. That you know. She was alive and well when I left her. There are many people who can testify to that. Therefore, being innocent of the crime, I can venture to appeal to you. Why must you mix yourself up in this business? If I swear to you on my honor that justice, and only justice, has been done, will you not abandon this inquiry? There has been so much suffering. You do not know. Now that at last there is peace and the possibility of happiness, must you destroy it all?"
Poirot sat up very straight. His eyes shone with a green light.
"Let me be clear, madame. What are you asking me to do? I am telling you that my mother-in-law died a natural death, and I am asking you to accept that statement. Let us be definite. You believe that your mother-in-law was deliberately killed, and you are asking me to condone murder? I'm asking you to have pity."
"Yes, on someone who had no pity."
"You do not understand. It was not like that. Did you commit the crime yourself, madame, that you know so well?"
Nadine shook her head. She showed no signs of guilt.
"No," she said quietly. "She was alive when I left her."
"And then?"
"What happened? You know? Or you suspect?"
Nadine said passionately,
"I have heard, Monsieur Poirot, that once, in that affair of the Orient Express, you accepted an official verdict of what had happened."
Poirot looked at her curiously.
"I wonder who told you that. Is it true?"
he said slowly.
"That case was different."
"No.
No, it was not different. The man who was killed was evil."
Her voice dropped.
"As she was."
Poirot said, "The moral character of the victim has nothing to do with it.
A human being who has exercised the right of private judgment and taken the life of another human being is not safe to exist amongst the community. I tell you that. I, Hercule Poirot.
How hard you are.
Madame, in some ways I am adamant. I will not condone murder. That is the final word of Hercule Poirot.
She got up. Her dark eyes flashed with sudden fire.
Then go on. Bring ruin and misery into the lives of innocent people. I have nothing more to say.
But I think, madame, that you have a lot to say.
No, nothing more.
But yes, what happened, madame, after you left your mother-in-law, whilst you and your husband were in the marquee together?
She shrugged her shoulders.
How should I know?
You do know, or you suspect.
She looked him straight in the eyes.
I know nothing, Monsieur Poirot.
Turning, she left the room.
After noting on his pad, NB-440, Poirot opened the door and called to the orderly whom Colonel Carberry had left at his disposal. An intelligent man with a good knowledge of English, he asked him to fetch Miss Carol Boynton. He looked with some interest at the girl as she entered, at the chestnut hair, the poise of the head, on the long neck, the nervous energy of the beautifully shaped hands. He said,
"Sit down, mademoiselle."
She sat down obediently. Her face was colourless and expressionless. Poirot began with a mechanical expression of sympathy, to which the girl acquiesced without any change of expression.
"And now, mademoiselle, you will recount to me how you spent the afternoon of the day in question."
Her answer came promptly, raising the suspicion that it had already been well rehearsed.
"After luncheon, we all went for a stroll. I returned to the camp."
Poirot interrupted.
"A little minute. Were you all together until then?"
"No. I was with my brother Raymond and Miss King for most of the time. Then I strolled off on my own."
"Thank you. And you were saying you returned to the camp. Do you know the approximate time?"
"I believe it was just about 5:10.
Poirot put down CB 5:10.
"And what then?"
"My mother was still sitting where she had been when we set out. I went up and spoke to her, and then went on to my tent."
"Can you remember exactly what passed between you?"
"I just said it was very hot and that I was going to lie down. My mother said she would remain where she was. That was all."
"Did anything in her appearance strike you as out of the ordinary?"
"No. At least, that is—"
She paused doubtfully, staring at Poirot.
"It is not from me that you can get the answer, mademoiselle," said Poirot quietly.
"I was just considering. I hardly noticed at the time, but now, looking back—"
"Yes?"
Carol said slowly.
"It is true. She was a funny color. Her face was very red, more so than usual."
"She might perhaps have had a shock of some kind?" Poirot suggested.
"A shock?"
She stared at him. "Yes, she might have had, let us say, some trouble with one of the Arab servants?"
"Oh."
Her face cleared.
"Yes, she might."
"She did not mention such a thing having happened?"
"No. No, nothing at all."
Poirot went on. "And what did you do next, mademoiselle?"
"I went to my tent and lay down for about 30 minutes. Then I went down to the marquee. My brother and his wife were there reading."
"And what did you do?"
"Oh, I had some sewing to do. Then I picked up a magazine."
"Did you speak to your mother again on your way to the marquee?"
"No. I went straight down. I don't think I even glanced in her direction."
"And then?"
"I remained in the marquee until Miss King told us she was dead."
"And that is all you know, mademoiselle?"
"Yes."
Poirot leaned forward. His tone was the same, light and conversational.
"And what did you feel, mademoiselle?"
"What did I feel?"
"Yes, when you found that your mother—pardon, your stepmother, was she not—what did you feel when you found her dead?"
She stared at him.
"I don't understand what you mean."
"I think you understand very well." Her eyes dropped. She said uncertainly,
"It was a great shock."
"Was it?"
The blood rushed to her face. She stared at him helplessly. Now he saw fear in her eyes.
Was it such a great shock, mademoiselle, remembering a certain conversation you had with your brother Raymond one night in Jerusalem?
His shot proved right. He saw it in the way the color drained out of her cheeks again.
You know about that?
She whispered. Yes, I know.
But how? How?
Part of your conversation was overheard.
Oh!
Carol Boynton buried her face in her hands. Her sobs shook the table. Hercule Poirot waited a moment, then he said quietly,
You were planning together to bring about your stepmother's death.
Carol sobbed out brokenly,
We were mad, mad that evening.
Perhaps.
It's impossible for you to understand the state we were in.
She sat up, pushing back the hair from her face.
It would sound fantastic. It wasn't so bad in America, but traveling brought it home to us so.
Brought what home to you? His voice was kind now, sympathetic.
Our being different from other people. We got desperate about it. And there was Ginny.
Ginny?
My sister. You haven't seen her. She was going, well, queer. And my mother was making her worse. She didn't seem to realize we were afraid, Ray and I, that Ginny was going quite mad. And we saw Nadine thought so, too. And that made us more afraid, because Nadine knows about nursing and things like that.
Yes, yes. That evening in Jerusalem, things kind of boiled up. Ray was beside himself. He and I got all strung up, and it seemed, oh, indeed, it did seem right to plan as we did.
Mother wasn't sane. I don't know what you think, but it can seem quite right, almost noble, to kill someone.
Poirot nodded his head slowly.
Yes, it has seemed so, I know, to many. That is proved by history. That is how Ray and I felt that night.
She beat her hand on the table.
But we didn't really do it. Of course we didn't do it. When daylight came, the whole thing seemed absurd, melodramatic. Oh, yes, and wicked, too. Indeed, indeed, Monsieur Poirot, Mother died perfectly naturally of heart failure. Ray and I had nothing to do with it.
Poirot said quietly, Will you swear to me, mademoiselle, as you hope for salvation after death, that Mrs. Boynton did not die as a result of any action of yours? She lifted her head. Her voice came steady and deep.
I swear, said Carol, as I hope for salvation, that I never harmed her.
Poirot leaned back in his chair.
So, he said, that is that.
There was a silence. Poirot thoughtfully caressed his superb moustache. Then he said,
What exactly was your plan?
Plan? Yes, you and your brother must have had a plan. In his mind, he ticked off the seconds before her answer came. 1, 2, 3.
We had no plan, said Carol at last. We never got as far as that.
Hercule Poirot got up.
That is all, mademoiselle. Will you be so good as to send your brother to me?
Carol rose. She stood undecidedly for a minute.
Monsieur Poirot, you do believe me?
Have I said, asked Poirot, that I do not?
No, but...
She stopped. He said,
You will ask your brother to come here.
Yes. She went slowly towards the door. She stopped as she got to it, turning round passionately.
I have told you the truth. I have.
Hercule Poirot did not answer. Carol Boynton went slowly out of the room. Poirot noted the likeness between brother and sister as Raymond Boynton came into the room. His face was stern and set. He did not seem nervous or afraid. He dropped into a chair, stared hard at Poirot, and said,
Well?
Poirot said gently,
Your sister has spoken with you?
Raymond nodded.
Yes, when she told me to come here. Of course, I realize that your suspicions are quite justified. If our conversation was overheard that night, the fact that my stepmother died rather suddenly certainly would seem suspicious. I can only assure you that the conversation was
the madness of an evening. We were at the time under an intolerable strain. This fantastic plan of killing my stepmother did, oh, how shall I put it, it let off steam somehow.
Hercule Poirot bent his head slowly.
That, he said, is possible.
In the morning, of course, it all seemed rather absurd. I swear to you, Monsieur Poirot, that I never thought of the matter again.
Poirot did not answer. Raymond said quickly, Oh, yes, I know that is easy enough to say. I cannot expect you to believe me on my bare word, but consider the facts. I spoke to my mother just a little before 6 o'clock. She was certainly alive and well then. I went to my tent, had a wash, and joined the others in the marquee. From that time onwards, neither Carol nor I moved from the place. We were in full sight of everyone. You must see, Monsieur Poirot, that my mother's death was natural, a case of heart failure. It couldn't be anything else. There were servants about, a lot of coming and going. Any other idea is absurd.
Poirot said quietly, Do you know, Mr. Boynton, that Miss King is of the opinion that when she examined the body at 6:30, death had occurred at least an hour and a half, and probably 2 hours earlier?
Raymond stared at him. He looked dumbfounded.
Sarah said that? He gasped.
Poirot nodded. What have you to say now?
But it's impossible.
That is Miss King's testimony. Now you come and tell me that your mother was alive and well only 40 minutes before Miss King examined the body.
Raymond said,
But she was. Be careful, Mr. Boynton.
Sarah must be mistaken. There must be some factor she didn't take into account. Refraction off the rock. Something.
I can assure you, Monsieur Poirot, that my mother was alive at just before 6, and that I spoke to her.
Poirot's face showed nothing. Raymond leant forward earnestly. Monsieur Poirot, I know how it must seem to you, but look at the thing fairly. You're a biased person. You're bound to be by the nature of things. You live in an atmosphere of crime. Every sudden death must seem to you a possible crime. Can't you realize that your sense of proportion is not to be relied upon? People die every day, especially people with weak hearts, and there is nothing in the least sinister about such deaths.
Poirot sighed. So, you would teach me my business, is that it?
No, of course not. But I do think that you were prejudiced. Because of that unfortunate conversation, there is nothing, really, about my mother's death to awaken suspicion except that unlucky, hysterical conversation between Carol and myself.
Poirot shook his head.
You are in error, he said. There is something else. There is the poison, taken from Dr. Gerard's medicine chest.
Poison?
Ray stared at him.
Poison?
He pushed his chair back a little. He looked completely stupefied.
Is that what you suspect?
Poirot gave him a minute or two. Then he said quietly, almost indifferently,
Your plan was different, eh?
Oh, yes, Raymond answered mechanically. That's why... This changes everything.
I can't think clearly.
What was your plan?
Our plan, it was...
Raymond stopped abruptly. His eyes became alert, suddenly watchful.
I don't think, he said, that I'll say any more.
As you please, said Poirot.
He watched the young man out of the room. He drew his pad towards him, and in small, neat characters, made a final entry. R.B. 5:55. Then, taking a large sheet of paper, he proceeded to write. His task completed, he sat back with his head on one side, contemplating the result. It ran as follows. Boynton's and Jefferson Cope leave the camp 3:05, approximately. Dr. Gerard and Sarah King leave the camp 3:15, approximately. Lady Westholme and Miss Pierce leave the camp 4:15. Dr. Gerard returns to camp 4:20, approximately. Lennox Boynton returns to camp 4:35. Nadine Boynton returns to camp and talks to Mrs. Boynton 4:40. Nadine Boynton leaves her mother-in-law and goes to Marquis 4:50, approximately. Carol Boynton returns to camp, 5:10. Lady Westholme, Miss Pierce, and Mr. Jefferson Cope return to camp, 5:40. Raymond Boynton returns to camp, 5:50. Sarah King returns to camp, 6 o'clock. Body discovered, 6:30.
"I wonder," said Hercule Poirot. He folded up the list, went to the door, and ordered Mahmoud to be brought to him. The stout dragoman was voluble. Words dripped from him in a rising flood.
"Always, always I am blamed. When anything happens, say always my fault, always my fault. When Lady Ellen Hunt sprained her ankle coming down from place of sacrifice, it is my fault, although she would go high-heeled shoes, and she's 60 at least, perhaps 70. My life, all one misery. Ah! What with miseries and iniquities Jews do to us!"
At last Poirot succeeded in stemming the flood and in getting in his question.
"Half past 5 o'clock, you say?"
"No. I not think any of servants were about then. You see, lunch is late. 2 o'clock. Then to clear it away. After lunch, all afternoon sleep."
"Yes. Americans, they not take tea. We all settle sleep by 3:30. At 5, I, who am soul of efficiency, always, always I watch for the comfort of ladies and gentlemen I serving, I come out knowing that time all English ladies want tea, but no one there. They all gone walking. For me, that is very well, better than usual. I can go back sleep. At 5:45, trouble begin. Large English lady, very grand lady, come back and want tea, although boys are now laying for dinner. She makes quite fuss. Says water must be boiling. I am to see myself. Ah, my good gentleman, what a life, what a life! I do all I can, always I blame, I..."
Poirot asked about the recriminations. "There's another small matter. The dead lady was angry with one of the boys. Do you know which one it was and what it was about?"
Mahmoud's hands rose to heaven.
"Should I know? But then truly not. Old lady did not complain to me."
"Could you find out?"
"No, my good gentleman, that would be impossible. None of the boys admitted for a moment. Old lady angry, you say? Naturally boys would not tell. Abdul said Mohammed, and Mohammed said Aziz, and Aziz said Aisha, and so on. They are all very stupid Bedouin. Understand nothing."
He took a breath and continued.
"Now I have advantage of mission and education. I recite to you Keats, Shelley. I had a dove and a sweet dove died."
Poirot flinched. Though English was not his native tongue, he knew it well enough to suffer from the strange enunciation of Mahmoud.
"Superbe," he said hastily. "Superbe. Definitely, I recommend you to all my friends."
He contrived to escape from the dragoman's eloquence. Then he took his list to Colonel Carberry, whom he found in his office. Carberry pushed his tie a little more askew and asked,
"Got anything?"
Poirot said, "Shall I tell you a theory of mine?"
"If you like,"
said Colonel Carberry, and sighed. One way and another, he had heard a good many theories in the course of his existence. "My theory is that criminology is the easiest science in the world. One has only to let the criminal talk. Sooner or later, he will tell you everything."
"I remember you said something of the kind before. Who's been telling you things?"
"Everybody." Briefly, Poirot retailed the interviews he had had that morning.
Said Carberry. "Yes, you've got hold of a pointer or two, perhaps. Pity of it is, they all seem to point in opposite directions. Have we got a case? That's what I want to know."
"No." Carberry sighed again.
"I was afraid not."
"But before nightfall," said Poirot, "you shall have the truth."
"Well, that's all you ever promised me," said Colonel Carberry, "and I rather doubted you getting that. Sure of it?"
"I am very sure."
"Must be nice to feel like that," commented the other.
If there was a faint twinkle in his eye, Poirot appeared unaware of it. He produced his list.
"Neat,"
said Carberry, approvingly. He bent over it. After a minute or two, he said,
"Know what I think?"
"I should be delighted if you would tell me."
"Young Raymond Boynton's out of it."
"Ah, you think so?"
"Yes. Clear as a bell what he thought. We might have known he'd be out of it, being, as in detective stories, the most likely person. Since you practically overheard him saying he was going to bump off the old lady, we might have known that meant he was innocent."
"You read the detective stories, yes?"
"Thousands of them,"
said Colonel Carberry. He added, and his tone was that of a wistful schoolboy,
"I suppose you couldn't do the things the detective does in books. Write a list of significant facts, things that don't seem to mean anything, but are really frightfully important, that sort of thing?"
"Ah," said Poirot kindly, You like that kind of detective story? But certainly, I will do it for you with pleasure.
He drew a sheet of paper towards him, and wrote quickly and neatly. Significant points. 1. Mrs. Boynton was taking a mixture containing digitalis. 2. Dr. Gerard missed a hypodermic syringe. 3. Mrs. Boynton took definite pleasure in keeping her family from enjoying themselves with other people. 4. Mrs. Boynton, on the afternoon in question, encouraged her family to go away and leave her. 5. Mrs. Boynton was a mental sadist. 6. The distance from the marquee to the place where Mrs. Boynton was sitting is, roughly, 200 yards. 7. Mr. Lennox Boynton said at first he did not know what time he returned to the camp, but later he admitted having set his mother's wristwatch to the right time. 8. Dr. Gerard and Miss Ginevra Boynton occupied tents next door to each other. 9. At 6:30, when dinner was ready, a servant was dispatched to announce the fact to Mrs. Boynton. The colonel perused this with great satisfaction.
"Capital!" he said. "Just the thing! You've made it difficult, and seemingly irrelevant, absolutely the authentic touch. By the way, it seems to me there are one or two noticeable omissions, but that, I suppose, is what you tempt the mug with?"
Poirot's eyes twinkled a little, but he did not answer.
"Point 2, for instance," said Colonel Carberry, tentatively. "Dr. Gerard missed a hypodermic syringe."
"Yes. He also missed a concentrated solution of digitalis, or something of that kind."
"The latter point," said Poirot, "is not important in the way the absence of his hypodermic syringe is important."
"Splendid!" said Colonel Carberry, his face irradiated with smiles. "I don't get it at all. I should have said the digitalis was much more important than the syringe. And what about that servant motif that keeps cropping up? A servant being sent to tell her dinner was ready, and that story of her shaking her stick at a servant earlier in the afternoon. You're not going to tell me one of my poor desert mutts bumped her off after all.
Because," added Colonel Carberry sternly,
"if so, that would be cheating."
Poirot smiled, but did not answer. As he left the office, he murmured to himself, "Incredible! The English never grow up." Sarah King sat on a hilltop, absently plucking up wild flowers. Dr. Gerard sat on a rough wall of stones near her. She said suddenly and fiercely,
"Why did you start all this? If it hadn't been for you—"
Dr. Gerard said slowly, "You think I should have kept silence?"
"Yes."
"Knowing what I knew?"
"Well, you didn't know," said Sarah.
The Frenchman sighed. "I did know. But I admit one can never be absolutely sure."
"Yes, one can," said Sarah uncompromisingly.
The Frenchman shrugged his shoulders. "You, perhaps."
Sarah said, "You had a fever, a high temperature. You couldn't be clear-headed about the business. The syringe was probably there all the time. And you may have made a mistake about the digitoxin, or one of the servants may have meddled with the case."
Gerard said cynically, "You need not worry. The evidence is almost bound to be inconclusive. You will see. Your friends the Boyntons will get away with it."
Sarah said fiercely, "I don't want that either."
He shook his head.
"You are illogical."
"Wasn't it you," Sarah demanded, "in Jerusalem, who said a great deal about not interfering? And now look."
"I have not interfered. I have only told what I know." "And I say you don't know it." "Oh, dear. There we are, back again. I'm arguing in a circle."
Gerard said gently, "I am sorry, Miss King." Sarah said in a low voice,
"You see, after all, they haven't escaped, any of them. She's still there. Even from her grave, she can still reach out and hold them. There was something terrible about her. She's just as terrible now she's dead. I feel she's enjoying all this."
She clenched her hands. Then she said, in an entirely different tone, a light, everyday voice,
"Well, that little man's coming up the hill."
Dr. Gerard looked over his shoulder.
"Ah, he comes in search of us, I think."
"'Is he as much of a fool as he looks?' asked Sarah. Dr. Gerard said gravely, "'He is not a fool at all.'
"'I was afraid of that,' said Sarah King. With somber eyes she watched the uphill progress of Hercule Poirot. He reached them at last, uttered a loud, "'Oof!' and wiped his forehead. Then he looked sadly down at his patent leather shoes.
"'Alas!' he said. "'This stony country! My poor shoes!'
"'You can borrow Lady Westholme's shoe-cleaning apparatus,' said Sarah unkindly, "'and her duster. She travels with a kind of patent housemaid's equipment.'
"'That will not remove the scratches, mademoiselle.'
Poirot shook his head sadly.
"'Perhaps not. Why on earth do you wear shoes like that in this sort of country?'
Poirot put his head a little on one side.
"'I'd like to have the appearance soignée,' he said.
"'I should give up trying for that in the desert,' said Sarah.
"'Women do not look their best in the desert,' said Dr. Gerard dreamily. "'But Miss King here, yes, she always looks neat and well turned out, but that Lady Westholme, in her great thick coats and skirts, and all those terrible unbecoming riding breeches and boots, quelle horreur de femme! And the poor Miss Pierce, her clothes so limp, like faded cabbage leaves, and the chains and the beads that clink. Even young Mrs. Boynton, who is a good-looking woman, is not what you call chic. Her clothes are uninteresting.
Sarah said restively,
"'Well, I don't suppose Monsieur Poirot climbed up here to talk about clothes.'
"'True,' said Poirot.
"'I came to consult Dr. Gerard. His opinion should be of value to me, and yours too, mademoiselle. You are young and up-to-date in your psychology.' I want to know, you see, all that you can tell me of Mrs. Boynton.
Well, don't you know all that by heart now? Asked Sarah.
No. I have a feeling, more than a feeling, a certainty, that the mental equipment of Mrs. Boynton is very important in this case. Such types as hers are no doubt familiar to Dr. Gerard.
From my point of view, she was certainly an interesting study, said the doctor.
Tell me.
Dr. Gerard was nothing loath. He described his own interest in the family group, his conversation with Jefferson Cope, and the latter's complete misreading of the situation.
"'He is a sentimentalist, then?' said Poirot.
"'Oh, essentially. He has ideals based, really, on a deep instinct of laziness. To take human nature at its best, and the world as a pleasant place, is undoubtedly the easiest course in life.' Jefferson Cope has, consequently, not the least idea what people are really like.
"'That might be dangerous sometimes,' said Poirot.
Dr. Gerard went on.
"'He persisted in regarding what I may describe as the Boynton situation as a case of mistaken devotion. Of the underlying hate, rebellion, slavery, and misery, he had only the faintest notion.
"'It is stupid, that,' Poirot commented. "'All the same,' went on Dr. Gerard. Even the most willfully obtuse of sentimental optimists cannot be quite blind. I think on the journey to Petra, Mr. Jefferson Cope's eyes were being opened.
And he described the conversation he had had with the American on the morning of Mrs. Boynton's death.
"'That is an interesting story, that story of a servant girl,' said Poirot thoughtfully. "'It throws light on the old woman's methods.'
Gerard said, "'It was altogether an odd, strange morning, that. You have not been to Petra, Monsieur Poirot. If you go, you must certainly climb to the place of sacrifice. It has an atmosphere.'
He described the scene in detail, adding, "'Mamselle here sat like a young judge, speaking of the sacrifice of one to save many. You remember, Miss King?'
Sarah shivered. "'Don't. Don't let's talk of that day.
No, no.' said Poirot. Let us talk of events further back in the past. I am interested, Dr. Gerard, in your sketch of Mrs. Boynton's mentality. What I do not quite understand is this. Having brought her family into absolute subjection, why did she then arrange this trip abroad, where surely there was danger of outside contacts and of her authority being weakened?
Dr. Gerard leaned forward excitedly.
But, mon vieux, that is just it. Old ladies are the same all the world over. They get bored. If their speciality is playing patience, they sicken of the patience they know too well. They want to learn a new patience,
And it is just the same with an old lady whose recreation, incredible as it may sound, is the dominating and tormenting of human creatures. Mrs. Boynton, to speak of her as une dompteuse, had tamed her tigers. There was perhaps some excitement as they passed through the stage of adolescence. Lennox's marriage to Nadine was an adventure, but then suddenly all was stale. Lennox is so sunk in melancholy that it is practically impossible to wound or distress him. Raymond and Carol show no signs of rebellion. Ginevra, ah, la pauvre Ginevra. She, from her mother's point of view, gives the poorest sport of all. For Ginevra has found a way of escape. She escapes from reality into fantasy. The more her mother goads her, the more easily she gets a secret thrill out of being a persecuted heroine. From Mrs. Boynton's point of view, it is all deadly dull. She seeks, like Alexander, new worlds to conquer. And so she plans the voyage abroad. There will be the danger of her tamed beasts rebelling. There will be opportunities for inflicting fresh pain. It sounds absurd, does it not? But it was so. She wanted a new thrill. Poirot took a deep breath.
It is perfect, that. Yes. I see exactly what you mean. It was so. It all fits in. She chose to live dangerously, la maman Boynton, and she paid the penalty.
Sarah leaned forward, her pale, intelligent face very serious.
You mean, she said, that she drove her victims too far, and they turned on her, or one of them did?
Poirot bowed his head. Sarah said, and her voice was a little breathless,
which of them?
Poirot looked at her, at her hands clenched fiercely on the wild flowers, at the pale rigidity of her face. He did not answer, was indeed saved from answering, for at that moment Gerard touched his shoulder and said, look. A girl was wandering along the side of the hill. She moved with a strange, rhythmic grace that somehow gave the impression that she was not quite real. The gold-red of her hair shone in the sunlight. A strange, secretive smile lifted the beautiful corners of her mouth. Poirot drew in his breath. He said,
how beautiful! How strangely, movingly beautiful! That is how Ophelia should be played. Like a young goddess, straying from another world, happy because she has escaped out of the bondage of human joys and griefs.
Yes. Yes, you are right, said Gerard. It is a face to dream of, is it not? I dreamt of it. In my fever, I opened my eyes and saw that face, with its sweet, unearthly smile. It was a good dream. I was sorry to wake.
Then, with a return to his commonplace manner,
that is Ginevra Boynton, he said.
In another minute the girl had reached them. Dr. Gerard performed the introduction.
Miss Boynton, this is Monsieur Hercule Poirot.
Oh.
She looked at him uncertainly. Her fingers, joined together, twined themselves uneasily in and out. The enchanted nymph had come back from the country of enchantment. She was now just an ordinary, awkward girl, slightly nervous and ill at ease. Poirot said,
it is a piece of good fortune meeting you here, mademoiselle. I tried to see you in the hotel.
Did you?
Her smile was vacant. Her fingers began plucking at the belt of her dress. He said gently,
will you walk with me a little way?
She moved docilely enough, obedient to his whim. Presently she said rather unexpectedly in a queer, hurried voice,
You are a detective, aren't you?
Yes, mademoiselle.
A very well-known detective?
The best detective in the world, said Poirot,
stating it as a simple truth, no more, no less. Ginevra Boynton breathed very softly.
You have come here to protect me.
Poirot stroked his moustache thoughtfully. He said,
are you then in danger, mademoiselle?
Yes, yes.
She looked round with a quick, suspicious glance.
I told Dr. Gerard about it in Jerusalem. He was very clever. He gave no sign at the time, but he followed me to that terrible place with the red rocks.
She shivered.
They meant to kill me there.
I have to be continually on my guard.
Poirot nodded gently and indulgently. Ginevra Moynton said,
He is kind and good. He's in love with me.
Yes?
Oh, yes. He says my name in his sleep.
Her voice softened. Again, a kind of trembling, unearthly beauty hovered there.
I saw him, lying there, turning and tossing, and saying my name. I stole away quietly.
She paused.
I thought perhaps he had sent for you. I have a terrible lot of enemies, you know. They're all around me. Sometimes they are disguised.
Yes, yes, said Poirot gently, but you are safe here, with all your family round you. She drew herself up proudly.
They are not my family. I have nothing to do with them. I cannot tell you who I really am. That is a great secret. It would surprise you if you knew.
He said gently, Was your mother's death a great shock to you, mademoiselle? Ginevra stamped her feet.
I tell you, she wasn't my mother. My enemies paid her to pretend she was, and to see I did not escape.
Where were you on the afternoon of her death?
I was in the tent. It was hot in there, but I didn't dare come out. They might have got me.
She gave a little quiver.
One of them looked into my tent. He was disguised, but I knew him. I pretended to be asleep. The Sheik had sent him. The Sheik wanted to kidnap me, of course.
For a few moments Poirot walked in silence. Then he said, They are very pretty, these histories you recount to yourself. She stopped. She glared at him.
They're true. They're all true.
Again she stamped an angry foot.
Yes, said Poirot.
They are certainly ingenious. She cried out.
They're true, true!
Then angrily she turned from him and ran down the hillside. Poirot stood looking after her. In a minute or two he heard a voice very close behind him. What did you say to her? Poirot turned to where Dr. Gerard, a little out of breath, stood beside him. Sarah was coming towards them both, but she came at a more leisurely pace. Poirot answered Gerard's question. I told her, he said, that she had imagined to herself some pretty stories. The doctor nodded his head thoughtfully. And she was angry. That is a good sign. It shows, you see, that she has not yet completely passed through the door. She still knows that it is not the truth. I shall cure her.
Ah, you are undertaking a cure?
Yes. I have discussed the matter with young Mrs. Boynton and her husband. Ginevra will come to Paris and enter one of my clinics. Afterwards, she will have her training for the stage.
The stage?
Yes, there is a possibility there for her of great success. And that is what she needs, what she must have. In many essentials, she has the same nature as her mother.
No,
cried Sarah, revolted. It seems impossible to you, but certain fundamental traits are the same. They were both born with a great yearning for importance. They both demand that their personalities shall impress. This poor child has been thwarted and suppressed at every turn. She has been given no outlet for her fierce ambition, for her love of life, for the expressions of her vivid, romantic personality. He gave a little laugh.
Nous allons changer tout ça.
Then with a little bow he murmured, You will excuse me. And he hurried down the hill after the girl. Sarah said, Dr. Gerard is tremendously keen on his job.
I perceive his keenness, said Poirot.
Sarah said with a frown, All the same, I can't bear his comparing her to that horrible old woman, although once I felt sorry for Mrs. Boynton myself.
When was that, mademoiselle?
That time I told you about in Jerusalem. I suddenly felt as though I'd got the whole business wrong. You know that feeling one has sometimes, when just for a short time you see everything the other way round. I got all het up about it, and went and made a fool of myself.
Oh, no, not that.
Sarah, as always when she remembered her conversation with Mrs. Boynton, was blushing acutely. I felt all exalted, as though I had a mission, and then later, when Lady W. fixed a fishy eye on me, and said she had seen me talking to Mrs. Boynton, I thought she had probably overheard, and I felt the most complete ass. Poirot said, What exactly was it that old Mrs. Boynton said to you? Can you remember the exact words?
I think so.
They made rather an impression on me. I never forget, that's what she said. Remember that?
I've never forgotten anything. Not an action, not a name, not a face.
Sarah shivered.
She said it so malevolently. Not even looking at me. I feel as if, even now, I can hear her.
Poirot said gently,
It impressed you very much.
Yes.
I'm not easily frightened. But sometimes I dream of her saying just those words in her evil, leering, triumphant face. Ugh!
She gave a quick shiver. Then she turned suddenly to him.
Monsieur Poirot, perhaps I ought not to ask, but have you come to a conclusion about this business? Have you found out anything definite?
Yes. He saw her lips tremble as she asked,
What?
I have found out to whom Raymond Boynton spoke that night in Jerusalem. It was to his sister Carol.
Carol, of course.
Then she went on,
Did you tell him? Did you ask him?
It was no use. She could not go on. Poirot looked at her gravely and compassionately. He said quietly,
It means so much to you, mademoiselle?
It means just everything, said Sarah. Then she squared her shoulders.
But I've got to know.
Poirot said quietly, He told me that it was a hysterical outburst. No more. That he and his sister were worked up. He told me that in daylight such an idea appeared fantastic to them both.
I see.
Poirot said gently,
Miss Sarah, will you not tell me what it is you fear?
Sarah turned a white, despairing face upon him.
That afternoon, we were together, and he left me saying he wanted to do something now. While he had the courage, I thought he meant just to tell her, but supposing he meant—
Her voice died away. She stood rigid, fighting for control. Nadine Boynton came out of the hotel. As she hesitated uncertainly, a waiting figure sprang forward. Mr. Jefferson Cope was immediately at his lady's side.
"Shall we walk up this way? I think it's the pleasantest," she acquiesced.
They walked along, and Mr. Cope talked. His words came freely, if a trifle monotonously. It is not certain whether he perceived that Nadine was not listening. As they turned aside onto the stony, flower-covered hillside, she interrupted him.
"Jefferson, I'm sorry. I've got to talk to you."
Her face had grown pale.
"Why, certainly, my dear. Anything you like, but don't distress yourself."
She said, "You're cleverer than I thought. You know, don't you, what I'm going to say?"
"It is undoubtedly true," said Mr. Cope, "that circumstances alter cases. I do feel very profoundly that in the present circumstances decisions may have to be reconsidered."
He sighed.
"You've got to go right ahead, Nadine, and do just what you feel."
She said with real emotion, "You're so good, Jefferson, so patient. I feel I've treated you very badly. I really have been downright mean to you.
Now look here, Nadine, let's get this right. I've always known what my limitations were where you were concerned. I've had the deepest affection and respect for you ever since I've known you. All I want is your happiness. That's all I ever wanted. Seeing you unhappy has very nearly driven me crazy. And I may say that I've blamed Lennox. I felt that he didn't deserve to keep you if he didn't value your happiness a little more than he seemed to do."
Mr. Cope took a breath and went on,
"Now, I'll admit that after traveling with you to Petra, I felt that perhaps Lennox wasn't quite so much to blame as I thought. He wasn't so much selfish where you were concerned as too unselfish where his mother was concerned. Now, I don't want to say anything against the dead, but I do think that your mother-in-law was perhaps an unusually difficult woman."
"Yes, I think you may say that," murmured Nadine.
"Anyway," went on Mr. Cope, "you came to me yesterday and told me that you definitely decided to leave Lennox. I applaud your decision."
It wasn't right, the life you were leading. You were quite honest with me. You didn't pretend to be more than just mildly fond of me. Well, that was all right with me. All I asked was the chance to look after you and treat you as you should be treated. I may say that afternoon was one of the happiest afternoons in my life. Nadine cried out, "I'm sorry. I'm sorry." "No, my dear, because all along I had a kind of feeling that it wasn't real. I felt it was quite on the cards that you would have changed your mind by the next morning. Well, things are different now. You and Lennox can lead a life of your own." Nadine said quietly, "Yes, I can't leave Lennox. Please forgive me." "Nothing to forgive," declared Mr. Cope. "You and I will go back to being old friends. We'll just forget about that afternoon." Nadine placed a gentle hand on his arm. "Dear Jefferson, thank you. I'm going to find Lennox now." She turned and left him. Mr. Cope went on alone. Nadine found Lennox sitting at the top of the Greco-Roman theatre. He was in such a brown study that he hardly noticed her till she sank breathless at his side. "Lennox." "Nadine," he half turned. She said, "We haven't been able to talk until now, but you know, don't you, that I'm not leaving you." He said gravely, "Did you ever really mean to, Nadine?" She nodded. "Yes. You see, it seemed to be the only possible thing left to do. I hoped that you would come after me. Poor Jefferson. How mean I've been to him." Lennox gave a sudden curt laugh. "No, you haven't. Anyone who is as unselfish as Cope ought to be given full scope for his nobility. And you were right, you know, Nadine. When you told me that you were going away with him, you gave me the shock of my life. You know, honestly, I think I must have been going queer or something lately. Why the hell didn't I snap my fingers in Mother's face and go off with you when you wanted me to?" She said gently, "You couldn't, my dear. You couldn't." Lennox said musingly, "Mother was a damn queer character. I believe she'd got us all half hypnotized." "She had." Lennox mused a minute or two longer. Then he said, "When you told me that afternoon, it was just like being hit a crack on the head. I walked back half dazed, and then, suddenly, I saw what a damn fool I'd been. I realized that there was only one thing to be done if I didn't want to lose you." He felt her stiffen. His tone became grimmer. "I went and—" "Don't." He gave her a quick glance. "I went and argued with her." He spoke with a complete change of tone, careful and rather toneless. "I told her that I'd got to choose between her and you, and that I chose you." There was a pause. He repeated in a tone of curious self-approval, "Yes, that's what I said to her." Poirot met two people on his way home. The first was Mr. Jefferson Cope.
"Oh, Monsieur Hercule Poirot! My name's Jefferson Cope."
The two men shook hands ceremoniously. Then, falling into step beside Poirot, Mr. Cope explained,
"It's just got round to me that you're making a kind of routine inquiry into the death of my old friend, Mrs. Boynton. That certainly was a shocking business. Of course, mind you, the old lady ought never to have undertaken such a fatiguing journey. But she was headstrong, Monsieur Poirot. Her family could do nothing with her. She was by way of being a household tyrant. It had her own way too long, I guess. It certainly is true that what she said went. Yes, sir, that certainly was true." There was a momentary pause. "I'd just like to tell you, Monsieur Poirot, that I'm an old friend of the Boynton family. Naturally, they're all a good deal upset over this business. They're a trifle nervous and highly strung, you know. So if there are any arrangements to be made, necessary formalities, arrangements for the funeral, transport of the body to Jerusalem, why, I'll take as much trouble as I can off their hands. Just call upon me for anything that needs doing.
"I am sure the family will appreciate your offer," said Poirot. He added, "You are, I think, a special friend of young Mrs. Boynton's."
Mr. Jefferson Cope went a little pink.
"Well, we won't say too much about that, Monsieur Poirot. I hear you had an interview with Mrs. Lennox Boynton this morning, and she may have given you a hint of how things were between us, but that's all over now. Mrs. Boynton is a very fine young woman, and she feels that her first duty is to her husband, in his sad bereavement."
There was a pause. Poirot received the information by a delicate gesture of the head. Then he murmured,
"It is the desire of Colonel Carberry to have a clear statement concerning the afternoon of Mrs. Boynton's death. Can you give me an account of that afternoon?"
"Why, certainly. After our luncheon and a brief rest, we set out for a kind of informal tour around. We escaped, I'm glad to say, without that pestilential dragoman. That man's just crazy on the subject of the Jews. I don't think he's quite sane on that point. Anyway, as I was saying, we set out. It was then that I had my interview with Nadine. Afterwards, she wished to be alone with her husband to discuss matters with him. I went off on my own, working gradually back towards the camp. About halfway there, I met the two English ladies who had been on the morning expedition. One of them's an English peeress, I understand."
Poirot said that such was the case.
"Ah, she's a fine woman, a very powerful intellect, and very well informed. The other seemed to me rather a weak sister, and she looked about dead with fatigue. That expedition in the morning was very strenuous for an elderly lady, especially when she doesn't like heights. Well, as I was saying, I met these two ladies and was able to give them some information on the subject of the Nabataeans. We went around a bit and got back to the camp about 6. Lady Westholm insisted on having tea, and I had the pleasure of having a cup with her. The tea was kind of weak, but it had an interesting flavor. Then the boys laid the table for supper and sent out to the old lady, only to find that she was sitting there, dead in her chair."
"Did you notice her as you walked home?"
"I did notice she was there. It was her usual seat in the afternoon and evening, but I didn't pay special attention. I was just explaining to Lady Westholm the conditions of our slump. I had to keep an eye on Miss Pierce, too. She was so tired she kept turning her ankles."
"Thank you, Mr. Cope. May I be so indiscreet as to ask if Mrs. Boynton is likely to have left a large fortune?"
"A very considerable one. That is to say, strictly speaking, it was not hers to leave. She had a life interest in it, and at her death it is divided between the late Elmer Boynton's children." "Yes. They will all be very comfortably off now."
"Money," murmured Poirot, "makes a lot of difference. How many crimes have been committed for it?"
Mr. Cope looked a little startled.
"Why, that's so, I suppose," he admitted.
Poirot smiled sweetly and murmured,
"But there are so many motives for murder, are there not?"
"Thank you, Mr. Cope, for your kind cooperation."
"You're welcome, I'm sure," said Mr. Cope. "Do I see Miss King sitting up there? I think I'll go and have a word with her."
Poirot continued to descend the hill. He met Miss Pierce fluttering up it. She greeted him breathlessly.
"Oh, Monsieur Poirot, I'm so glad to meet you. I've been talking to that very odd girl, the youngest one, you know. She has been saying the strangest things about enemies and some sheikh that wanted to kidnap her, and how she has spies all around her. Really, it sounded most romantic. Lady Westholm says it's all nonsense, and that she once had a red-headed kitchen-maid who told lies just like that. But I think sometimes that Lady Westholm is rather hard. And after all, it might be true, mightn't it, Monsieur Poirot? I read some years ago that one of the Tsar's daughters was not killed in the revolution in Russia, but escaped secretly to America. The Grand Duchess Tatiana, I think it was. If so, this might be her daughter, mightn't it? She did hint at something royal, and she has a look, don't you think, rather Slavonic. Those cheekbones, how thrilling it would be!"
Poirot said somewhat sententiously,
"It is true that there are many strange things in life." "I didn't really take in this morning who you were," said Miss Pierce, clasping her hands. "Of course, you are that very famous detective. I read all about the ABC case. It was so thrilling.
I had actually a post as governess near Doncaster at the time."
Poirot murmured something. Miss Pierce went on with growing agitation.
"That is why I felt perhaps I had been wrong this morning. One must always tell everything, must one not? Even the smallest detail, however unrelated it may seem. Because, of course, if you were mixed up in this, poor Mrs. Boynton must have been murdered. I see that now. I suppose Mr. Marmoud, I cannot remember his name, but the dragoman, I mean, I suppose he could not be a Bolshevik agent, or even perhaps Miss King. I believe many quite well-brought-up girls of good family belong to those dreadful communists. That's why I wondered if I ought to tell you, because, you see, it was rather peculiar when one comes to think of it."
"Precisely," said Poirot, "and therefore you will tell me all about it."
"Well, it's not really anything very much. It's only that on the next morning, after the discovery, I was up rather early, and I looked out of my tent to see the effect of the sunrise, you know. Only, of course, it wasn't actually sunrise, because the sun must have risen quite an hour before. But it was early."
"Yes, yes, and you
saw—" "That's the curious thing. At least, at the time, it didn't seem much. It was only that I saw that Boynton girl come out of her tent and fling something right out into the stream. And nothing in that, of course, but it glittered in the sunlight. As it went through the air, it glittered, you know.
Which Boynton girl was it?"
"I think it was the one they call Carol. A very nice-looking girl, so like her brother. Really, they might be twins. Or, of course, it might have been the youngest one. The sun was in my eyes, so I couldn't quite see, but I don't think the hair was red, just bronze. I'm so fond of that coppery bronze hair. Red hair always says carrots to me."
She tittered.
"And she threw away a brightly glittering object?"
said Poirot.
"Yes, and of course, as I said, I didn't think much of it at the time. But later, I walked along the stream and Miss King was there. And there, amongst a lot of other very unsuitable things, even a tin or two, I saw a little bright metal box. Not an exact square, a sort of long square, if you understand what I mean."
"But yes, I understand perfectly. About so long?"
"Yes. How clever of you. And I thought to myself, I suppose that's what the Boynton girl threw away. But it's a nice little box. And just out of curiosity, I picked it up and opened it. It had a kind of syringe inside. The same thing they stuck into my arm when I was being inoculated for typhoid. And I thought, how curious to throw it away like that, because it didn't seem broken or anything. But just as I was wondering, Miss King spoke behind me. I hadn't heard her come up. And she said, 'Oh, thank you. That's my hypodermic. I was coming to look for it.' So I gave it to her, and she went back to the camp with it."
Miss Pierce paused, and then went on hurriedly,
"And, of course, I expect there's nothing in it, only it did seem a little curious that Carol Boynton should throw away Miss King's syringe. I mean, it was odd, if you know what I mean. Though, of course, I expect there's a very good explanation."
She paused, looking expectantly at Poirot. His face was grave.
"Thank you, mademoiselle. What you have told me may not be important in itself, but I will tell you this. It completes my case. Everything is now clear and in order."
"Oh, really?" Miss Pierce looked as flushed and pleased as a child. Poirot escorted her to the hotel. Back in his own room, he added one line to his memorandum. Point number 10. "I never forget. Remember that. I've never forgotten anything."
"Mais oui," he said. "It is all clear now."